and welcome to NewsHour live from the BBC World Service in London. I'm Rebecca Kesby. We begin the programme today in Gaza, where the Hamas-run health ministry is now saying at least 93 people have been killed, including children, after a multi-storey residential building was hit by an Israeli airstrike. Rescue workers are saying dozens of people are still trapped under the rubble. The building is in Beit Lahia, which is in the very far north of the Gaza Strip. This man said many people had been crowded into the building when the strike happened. And I should warn you that this description of what he saw is graphic.
The house of the Abu Nasser family in the Beit Lahia project neighbourhood was bombed. The house had four floors. Dozens of people have been killed. Dozens of displaced people were living in this house. It was bombed without prior warning. As you can see, there are dead people here and there with body parts hanging off the walls. They are the neighbours and residents of Beit Lahia.
Well, a spokesperson for the Hamas-run Gaza Civil Defence Agency, Mahmoud Bassel, said that rescuers didn't have the equipment or supplies they needed to help survivors.
There are still civilians missing beneath the rubble, with no means to provide them aid or rescue them. People are crying out from beneath the rubble, but no one can offer them anything.
Well, we've approached the Israeli military for an interview this evening on what happened today in Beit Lahia. They sent us this statement. They say the details of the incident are being looked into. The IDF calls on the media to act with caution about information released by Hamas sources, as they've been proven to be deeply unreliable in previous incidents. The statement goes on. The IDF is conducting targeted operations and making efforts to avoid causing harm to uninvolved civilians. It says, we emphasise that the area was evacuated by the IDF and has been for weeks. It's currently an active combat zone. That was the statement sent to us about an hour or so ago by the Israeli Defence Forces. Well, earlier I spoke to a woman in Gaza. She's a school teacher. She didn't want us to use her name because of her security, but she told me she had friends in the area where the airstrike took place, and I asked her if she'd heard the explosion.
Yeah, not only that airstrike, but every airstrike that they are having around day and night, just because we are 10 minutes away from all the northern area of Gaza, we can hear all the bombardments. We can hear all the house demolishing as well. We can hear all the different kind of bombardments. Every one of them is different. And even we can realize when there is a new weapon being used for killing people over there.
Well, so we have heard from the health ministry in Gaza that they're saying that more than 90 people might have been killed in this particular strike. And there are others still trapped, it seems, under the rubble. Mm-hmm. What do you know of that situation there?
First of all, unfortunately, you only know about this incident because some people have managed to get to the hospital and inform the media about what happened to that building. Other people who have been killed and trapped under the rubble of their buildings or even being killed in the streets, and no one knew about that incident. Well, although the number is striking, but it makes complete sense for everybody here because usually people have refuge with relatives and friends. So if there's a five-story building or a seven-story building, usually each apartment in that building will have around more than 20 people in one apartment because people get together, especially when they escape from the area that the occupation has some kind of ground invasion or the area that has a heavy bombardment. So people came together in this building to find refuge, but unfortunately the occupation have targeted all of them. And it's not necessarily that they wanted some kind of a person over there. It's just they are bombarding all that area.
I understand what you're saying. And you're right that, many of these attacks people never hear of just because, you know, the information doesn't come out. But with this particular one, I mean, the Israeli government would say, look, we told civilians to leave this area because we want to target Hamas militants. Mm-hmm. And we did tell people that if they didn't want to get caught up in the violence to leave. What would you say to that? And why have people not left?
That's completely absurd. How can you just ask someone to leave his home? We have had this kind of story back in 1948, and everybody here, if you ask anybody in the street, even children, they will tell you, we are not going to repeat the mistake of our ancestors who fled for their lives in 1948. So people are not leaving for that reason. That's number one. Number two, they say where to go. There's no safe place in Gaza to go to.
Yesterday, the Israeli parliament voted to ban UNRWA, which is the agency, which is the biggest humanitarian agency in the Gaza Strip. What's your reaction to that?
This is a very absurd decision because they provide all kinds of services to the refugees in the Gaza Strip, in the West Bank, in Jerusalem, in the camps in Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon. They provide health care, they provide education for the people and aid in terms of food security.
Can you understand why Israeli politicians are suspicious of some UNRWA workers, though? Because they say they've got evidence that some UNRWA workers were involved in those Hamas attacks on the 7th of October.
That's completely funny when you say it like this, because every time they say we are suspicious about this and that, they make a claim to the world and the world media catches these kinds of claims. They amplify it. And then after a while, everybody discovers that it was a complete lie.
And that was a teacher in the Gaza Strip speaking to us a short time ago. She didn't want us to use her name because she's worried about her security. Well, dozens of people who were injured in that airstrike in Beit Lahia were taken to the nearby hospital in Jabalia. The Kamal Adwan Hospital was raided last week by the Israeli Defence Forces, who said it was being used by Hamas fighters. The Israeli government says Hamas, which is considered a terror organisation by many Western states, uses civilian buildings like hospitals and schools as human shields for their militant activities. But the director of that hospital, Hassam Abu Safir, told journalists today that it was struggling now to help the injured from today's explosion because he said there's nothing left in the hospital after that IDF raid. The humanitarian situation is particularly bad in the north of Gaza. Today, international calls have continued for Israel to reverse its decision to ban UNRWA, the UN agency responsible for humanitarian aid in Gaza and the West Bank.
92 בעד, 10 נגד, אני קובע כי הצעת החוק התקבלה בקריאה השלישית.
Well, that was the moment last night when the Speaker of the Israeli Parliament, the Knesset, announced that it had voted by 92 votes to 10 to ban UNRWA, which the Israeli government says has been infiltrated by Hamas militants, an accusation the UN strongly denies. One of the members of the Knesset who voted against banning UNRWA, one of the 10, was Ada Tuma Suleiman from Hadash. That's a left-wing Jewish and Arab party in Israel. And she told us what the atmosphere was like in the Knesset yesterday.
I have to say it was one of the most difficult scenes that you can see and hear through deliberations in any parliament, because mainly it consisted a lot of incitement, even against us as those who wanted to vote against and oppose those two actually laws, not one of them. There were two laws that were promoted and legislated yesterday. One is banning work of UNRWA in East Jerusalem, and the other one is banning any contact or coordination with the employees and with the organization by Israeli authorities, which means actually banning any activity not only in East Jerusalem, but also in the West Bank and Gaza. There were a lot of shouting, a lot of throwing accusations that we are supporters of terror and the supporters of killing Israeli citizens, which is not only an incitement that can be only in the parliament. It is broadcasted live, and it is incitement of the whole population of Israel against us.
And this was not only against UNRWA. And these insults and comments were hurled at you. You were one of the 10. I mean, we heard that there were quite angry scenes. What did you make of 92 members of the Knesset voting to ban UNRWA? I mean, you might expect Mr. Netanyahu's supporters to get behind that bill, but what about other parties? Were you surprised at how many MKs voted for it.
I wasn't surprised because, as you know, when you are dealing with a law, you just try to find out from the deliberations in the committee, which are supposed to prepare those legislations, who is supporting and who is opposing. And it's nothing new for us in the last year that large parts of the so-called opposition of the government is actually supporting the government in everything. They claim very highly that they are against the government, but whenever there are such laws, they always support. They go by the narrative that is said by Netanyahu's government and his coalition.
I just wanted to ask you this, because you are an Arab Israeli. There's about 20%...
I'm a Palestinian citizen of Israel. I would to use that
apologies.
Definition.
Apologies, yes, let's put it that way.
No, it's okay.
But I think that about 20% of the population in Israel is Arab or Palestinian, aren't they? Yeah. And you said that you were being, you know, hurled these comments at you, and some of them were inciting. And I understand that you've had quite a number of death threats over the past year.
That's true. Actually, it's a matter of everyday threats that are coming to my office or on the social media, and even, through the letters and phone calls threatening. It's not only for me, it's all, actually to all my colleagues in the party. We have been warned even by the security that we should be careful.
Does that make you question your role in the parliament? Does it make you think about, you know, giving up?
Actually, the first reaction is that I'm realizing more and more that my voice, it looks like it is important. Otherwise, it wouldn't have irritated them that much. If I wasn't reflecting the reality on the ground and bringing a different voice, that I should say clearly, it's a voice calling for peace. We have been saying from the beginning, wars will never, never solve any problem or end the occupation and the conflict situation between the two people. We believe that only diplomatic and political efforts that should solve the issue.
Ada Touma Suleiman there from Hadash, a left-wing Jewish and Arab party in Israel. She's one of the members of the Knesset there and was explaining what happened in the Israeli parliament yesterday. Do stay with us. You're live with NewsHour from the BBC World Service. Coming up later in the programme.
It's like going to Mecca for film, to see a film festival that opens in a stadium of 60,000 people and that the whole city of Ouagadougou is a standstill. It's incredible.
More on why Africa's most famous film festival could be facing an uncertain future later in the programme. Our main headlines this hour: the UN Secretary General and the US State Department have both expressed their outrage at Israel's decision to ban the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees. They've warned there could be consequences. And Ukraine has announced the mobilisation of another 160,000 men as Russia continues its offensive in the east. We'll have the latest on that story later this hour. This is Rebecca Kesby with NewsHour live from the BBC. Now, although millions of Americans have already voted, the big day is, of course, this time next week. And while both candidates continue on their relentless campaign trails, another political big beast has re-emerged. Steve Bannon, formerly one of Donald Trump's closest advisers, has been released from prison today. He was serving 4 months for contempt of Congress, having refused to appear before a committee investigating the attacks on the US Capitol building by Trump supporters in January 2021. Mr. Bannon is considered by some to have been the chief architect of the campaign that won Mr. Trump the election in 2016. He's considered even by his political supporters, as a radical disruptor. While speaking at a news conference in New York in the past couple of hours, Steve Bannon accused the Democratic administration of a political vendetta against the conservative grassroots movement.
They have weaponized the Justice Department against a political movement, a conservative grassroots movement that's had President Trump's back, and from the dark days of February, March, and April of 2021 is on the cusp of the biggest political comeback in the history of this nation, led by grassroots people, everyday Americans, including, as we know now from the polling, and the reason I said we're on the cusp of a massive victory.
Ken Benzinger covers right-wing media and national political campaigns for the New York Times. So what else did Steve Bannon have to say today?
Well, he came out with a roar, kind of as promised, or as one would expect, no less from Steve Bannon. He had a message that he said multiple times that he found the experience of being in prison empowering. He used the term. He felt empowered a couple times and talked a lot about what he saw in prison and what he learned from that and why he's confident based on what he saw in prison that Donald Trump is going to win the election on Tuesday. So it was like it really felt like a roaring campaign speech on the stump right out the prison gate.
Right. Well, and there's only 7 days to go. So how much of a difference can he make in Trump's campaign? And actually, I mean, is there a danger that he may turn Trump voters off?
You know, that was one of the questions. I mean, Trump has a rally in Pennsylvania, in Allentown, Pennsylvania, just in a couple hours. And one of the questions was whether Steve Bannon would appear on stage at the rally to speak to the crowd. It's not clear if he will. Seems like he might not. I guess we'll see. But another person close to Trump, Peter Navarro, who was sent to prison for the same reason earlier this year, when he was released, immediately traveled by private plane to Milwaukee for the Republican National Convention and spoke on stage there. If we don't see a repeat of that kind of performance from Bannon, it might be because that's not the kind of message that Trump wants to send in the final days of the campaign.
Well, I mean, it's interesting you say that. Yeah, because, I mean, we had those comments, didn't we, at that huge rally in Madison Square Gardens. These are comments from the comedian Tony Hinchcliffe talking about Puerto Rico. That's really rubbed a lot of Latino voters up the wrong way. And Mr. Trump doesn't really have much control over that.
Yeah, that's right. I think and Bannon addressed that in his press conference now, and he called those comments regrettable. But he also said he's convinced that Trump has sort of made huge headway with Latino and Black voters and thinks that they, you know, especially male voters in those category, in those sort of demographics, he thinks they've turned around and are going to support Trump more than ever. And I think maybe Trump, especially after that rally in Madison Square Garden, is going to be super careful to try to prevent people from going off script and saying things that he doesn't want to say. In Bannon's case, I think there's less of a risk of him offending a group like Puerto Ricans and more of a risk of him talking about things like election denialism and denying the results of the 2020 election. In fact, that was something he brought up in his press conference. So Trump may want to steer away from things that suggest that he's less than totally democratic in his approach to elections.
And just briefly, Ken, I mean, Steve Bannon did fall out with Mr. Trump at one point, didn't he? I don't know if they're friends again now or whether there could be a role for him in any Trump administration to come.
Well, I mean, it's a roller coaster love affair, hate affair between those two. Bannon has worked for Trump several times and has been in and out of the circle here and there. For what it's worth, he said in his press conference this morning that he has talked to Trump since getting out of prison. He's only been out of prison for a few hours. So an indication of that, of their closeness, is they've already been on the phone together. Mm. I mean, if I had a crystal ball, I would suggest that Trump wouldn't immediately hire Bannon into the White House. I don't think if he were to be elected, I don't think he necessarily meshes with the people that are closest to Trump right now.
Okay.
But he's considered really valuable to Trump as a outside kind of communications specialist. And that's where he thrives the best. It's important to note before you boot me off that Bannon also has more criminal problems ahead of him. He's got another trial for a different criminal issue coming up in 6 weeks. So he may be behind bars by the time Trump gets into office.
Ken Benzinger there from the New York Times. Now, when Japanese baseball player Shohei Ohtani signed a staggering $700 million 10-year deal with the Los Angeles Dodgers, many wondered if any athlete was worth that payday. But now many think the star player was worth every penny, as the BBC's Regan Morris reports from LA.
For every home run Shohei Ohtani hits, Don Tejada pours free shots of sake for his customers.
Because I'm a lifelong Dodger fan, so obviously when he hits a home run, it's good for the Dodgers. You know, maybe it's not so great for my pocketbook, but you know, but it's meaningful, and it warms my heart. Everyone's cheering. It's a win-win.
When did you start that tradition, and do you regret it? Because my gosh, he hits a lot of home runs.
Well, we never would have guessed he would hit so many.
Don owns Far Bar in L.A.'s Little Tokyo, which has become the center of L.A.'s love of all things Ohtani. The Far Bar was packed for Game 3 of the World Series, and even though Ohtani didn't hit any home runs, it didn't dampen the mood.
Ohtani fans?
Yeah, of course.
Takatana Kiyuchi and two of his friends came from Tokyo to watch the Dodgers. They attended Game 2 when the other Dodgers Japanese star, Yoshinobu Yamamoto, pitched six innings, allowing just one hit by the Yankees.
Did you come from Japan just for this?
Just for the game. And we're going back tomorrow. Oh, what's
that game? And you're all head-to-toe in Dodgers gear. Have you been to L.A. before?
50 years ago, yes.
And they're not alone. LA's tourism board says there were 230,000 visitors from Japan last year, up more than 91% from the previous year. And they're projecting a significant Ohtani effect boost when this year's numbers are finalized. Shohei Ohtani looms large over Little Tokyo. Literally, there's a 150-foot-tall mural of the slugger on the side of the historic Miyako Hotel. The muralist Robert Vargas, splattered in paint, was treated like a rock star by the crowd at Far Bar.
Well, that mural is so important to this community. My whole reason for painting it is really about representation. So that mural is hopefully instilling pride in some of the children to see someone that looks like them up there. I painted that mural at the beginning of the season, so this pre-World Series, but maybe a precursor for things to come, because he's looking up as he hits a home run. So.
And things are looking up for Little Tokyo. Win or lose the World Series, for a new group of fans, this neighborhood is now also known as Dodger Town.
The BBC's Regan Morris with that report from LA. And baseball fans will know that the LA Dodgers are facing their old rivals, the New York Yankees, in Game 4 of the World Series in New York in just a few hours' time. And no doubt lots more on that on the BBC Sports page. Welcome back to NewsHour. The Pan-African Film and Television Festival of Ouagadougou, better known as FESPACO, is one of Africa's oldest and largest movie festivals. Since 1969, FESPACO has been held every 2 years in Burkina Faso's capital. It only accepts entrants by African filmmakers, and their productions must be substantially made on the continent. But in 2022, a military junta seized power in a coup, casting the future of the event into doubt. Now FESPACO is being honoured at another festival here in London. The BBC's Richard Hamilton went along.
An extract from Mohamed Chalouf's documentary about FESPACO called Ouaga, screened at Film Africa in London. FESPACO's opening night, recorded in this scene, is always held in the National Stadium in Ouagadougou. Chalouf explores the history of the festival from its inception in 1969 and includes the assassination in 1987 of the president of Burkina Faso, Thomas Sankara, who had championed the event. But Mohamed Chalouf says FESPACO now faces a new challenge, the current military regime.
Yes, there are problems in Burkina Faso. Participation has been badly affected. For many Africans, it's still an opportunity to meet other filmmakers. but there are lots of people from north of the Mediterranean who dare not go there or are boycotting it because it's being held in a country which has adopted a new kind of politics, firmly against France.
One visible sign of that anti-French sentiment came during demonstrations that followed the coup in 2022, when the French Institute in Ouagadougou was ransacked and two of its screening rooms were destroyed.
It's like going to Mecca for film, to see a film festival that opens in a stadium of 60,000 people and that the whole city of Ouagadougou is a standstill. It's incredible.
Keith Shiri, who's originally from Zimbabwe, is the curator of Film Africa in London.
There has always been challenges with this festival. It's one of the most poorest countries in the continent. People are really thinking about what's going to happen given that these military governments have been at odds with the government of France. But the French have been always been supportive of FESPACO. Some of the organizations, institutions are not being discouraged from attending because when you go in there as a citizen of France, you never know what might happen.
Burkina Faso, Mali and Niger have all been overrun by military juntas, which are fighting Islamist insurgencies. There's no doubt that FESPACO has suffered as a result. But the organisers say the show must go on, and the next edition of this famous festival is due to be staged in Ouagadougou in February next year.
The BBC's Richard Hamilton with that report. You're listening to NewsHour live from the BBC. I'm Rebecca Kesby. Azerbaijan will be hosting the next UN Climate Change Conference, COP29, in November. Global efforts to tackle climate change are wildly off track, the UN said this week. New data shows that warming gases are accumulating faster than at any time in human existence. Well, environmentalists are also concerned that a petrostate like Azerbaijan is holding this event. We'll hear from the Azeri ambassador to COP29 in a moment. First, though, let's hear from our science and climate reporter, Esme Stallard. What's likely to be on the agenda this year?
Last year, there was a commitment to try and transition away from fossil fuels. They're trying to tighten up the language on that. But of course, that was a really controversial issue last year. So, I mean, whether we'll actually get something on that is as yet unclear. The other main goal is around this new quantified goal for finance. So listeners may remember that there was that previous goal for developed nations to commit to giving $100 billion a year by 2020 and every year after that. That now needs to be revised, and revised up is the ask from developing nations. That goal wasn't actually achieved on time. So even if we do get this new goal for finance, how quickly will that money actually come forward? And the other key area that countries are looking to finalise is something called Article 6, which effectively is a global trading system for carbon credits. So those industries that are producing a bit too much carbon, can they buy credits from another industry which is doing better to reduce its emissions?
Okay, so a lot of this is around the whole loss and damages idea, whereby richer countries would put money into a fund and then poorer countries would be able to draw down that money when they were affected by climate change. Is the money coming in?
At the moment, we know that some countries have said that they are willing to give more money. Europe has said that, but it's still to be seen what that final goal might be.
This year, COP29 is being hosted by Azerbaijan. That has been seen as something of a controversial choice. Why?
Well, for two reasons. First of all, who is actually organising the conference within the country? So Azerbaijan government decided that Mukhtar Babayev would be the president designate, so effectively head up the negotiations. He is the current Minister for Ecology, so potentially makes sense as a choice. But he was also a former oil exec at Sokar, which is a state-run oil company. It doesn't necessarily mean that obviously he's going to be pushing fossil fuels, but there is concerns because earlier this year in April, at a meeting of ministers around COP29, Babayev said that Azerbaijan was looking to expand its gas operations in response to European demand. So there is a concern, there is a conflict of interest there, whether he will continue to push where it's needed to tackle climate change and not actually be also pushing the agenda of soccer. And the second issue is obviously concern over human rights. So Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International and other organisations have said that they are concerned there has been an increased crackdown on political activists, eco-activists within the country since Azerbaijan was announced as the host of COP29. And they have claimed that the president is using COP29 almost as an excuse to clean up his opposition.
The BBC's Esme Stallard there. And as Esme was saying, some environmentalists believe petrostate Azerbaijan is not the right place to be holding a climate change conference. Its economy relies on fossil fuels. Oil and gas production accounts for about half its GDP and more than 92% of its export revenue. I've been speaking to Elchin Amirbayev. He's the special representative of the president of Azerbaijan for special assignments, including the COP summit. He came into our NewsHour studio and I put some of those criticisms from environmentalists to him that the Azeri climate record is poor.
Well, I would disagree with this premise. First of all, because Azerbaijan does not deny that it's a hydrocarbon-producing nation. But I think it's even more important to give the chance to those countries who are known as exporters of oil and gas to contribute to this overall effort. And Azerbaijan has made important strides in its national transition to renewable energies. And I think we do understand the urgency of the moment. And we aim to increase, for example, the renewable power capacity of renewable energies in Azerbaijan from 17% to 27% in 3 years' time. So basically, until 2030.
What about CO2 emissions? Because that's one of the things that you've been critical
of. Yeah, but again, if you look at this scale, you know, global scale, the percentage of Azerbaijan is less than 0.1%. You know, this is not something that we should be criticized for. But again, going back to the outcome of this summit and of this COP29, we do our best in order to achieve this meaningful outcome. But you should also understand that as a host country, there are certain limits to what we can achieve, because it's a party-driven exercise and it will depend very much on how countries who are the biggest polluters and who are biggest emission producers, you know, are they close enough to understand the urgency of the moment?
I mean, you have come in for criticism on Azerbaijan's human rights record, though, as well. And there are more than 300 political prisoners behind bars in Azerbaijan. And these are, some of them are journalists, there are academics there, there are political activists. There's been a report recently by Chatham House that's talking about a pre-COP crackdown, which has led to more arrests of activists ahead of that.
I would actually reject those figures because they have nothing to do with reality. I wonder what are the sources, you know, of this information of 300, well, first of all.
It's coming
secondly,
from Chatham House.
Yeah, but Chatham House, I mean, again, it's a big question where they are sourcing their information from. And then as far as the political prisoners are concerned, you know, there is no such a thing as a clear definition of what is political prisoners. Of course, there are some people who are now detained and against whom there are some legal investigation. But again, it's the job of the judiciary to come up with the outcome of those investigations. But I think that Azerbaijan, generally speaking, is a country which is doing a lot in terms of democratization and improvement of the record of human rights.
How do you respond to the what looks like criticism coming from the European Parliament as well? This is just in the past few days. There was a resolution on October the 24th asking that EU end its reliance on gas exports from Azerbaijan and actually sanction Azerbaijani officials who have committed serious human rights violations, it says. And it says that Azerbaijan's human rights record with Armenia in particular makes it incompatible to host COP29.
Well, I think that we should take the resolution of the European Parliament at its true value, because, I mean, if you look who was initiating this resolution, it's, again, those people who are proud in identifying themselves as pro-Armenian lobby and against Azerbaijan. So one of them is the French MP and the European Parliament, Nathalie Loiseau.
Well, I think they're pointing to the people that have been displaced from Nagorno-Karabakh, aren't they?
This resolution has left no subject untouched in order to criticise Azerbaijan for all the wrongs that there are. Our official authorities have reacted to this resolution. We think that it's very much biased. It has nothing to do with helping countries in the region to reach the peace process that they have embarked upon and where we have made important progress.
Are you confident that you can have a productive conference and you can reach agreement and Azerbaijan can push through what you said at the beginning you wanted to do, given that there are all these questions and criticisms coming in your direction?
Of course, as a host country, we are ready to do whatever it takes for a host country to do. And we have used this opportunity to launch the COP truce appeal on the model of the Olympic truce in order to ask all those who are now holding hands to put those guns down. Because I think that now is the moment when this whole international community has to concentrate on the challenges faced by this climate change, which is a huge problem for all of us.
So just on that, you want any warring parties at war anywhere, I guess, to put down their guns for the period of the COP conference?
That's right. And that's the appeal which was already supported by about 130 states in the world. And of course, we also hope that in the coming weeks, we will be able to break through progress in order to finalize the process of normalization of relations between Armenia and Azerbaijan. This is a process in which we have been already for more than 2 years. And I think that now we have to expeditiously address the remaining obstacles to peace between these two nations so that we could leave this rivalry and confrontation in the past.
Elchin Amirbayev there, Azeri ambassador to COP29. Now, a new exhibition about significant women from medieval times is on at the British Library in London at the moment. One of the most fascinating characters featured is Hildegard of Bingen, or Saint Hildegard as she became. The 12th century Benedictine nun was a total polymath. She studied science, she fought against corruption in the church, and to top it all, she was a prolific composer. The BBC's Nicola Stanbridge has been along to find out more about her and her lovely music.
I'm walking into St Andrew's Church, Raveningham, Norfolk. Composer Laura Cannell is playing with the acoustics and history of the church here as inspiration for her mixture of early music, folk, and experimental reimagining of Hildegard of Bingen.
My process is based on location, like a duet with the building, built around the same time that Hildegard was alive, composing and playing and writing music. It's absolutely the perfect loudspeaker for the recorder, speaking across centuries. I might just take four notes and loop it and loop it and loop it until I find something in there. I just think there's such beauty and such tiny detail. I love the title of that one, The Fiery Spirit, Origine Spiritus.
Margot Fassler is Professor Emerita of Music and Liturgy at the University of Notre Dame in America, a leading expert on Hildegard, how she influenced popes and emperors, contributed to science, music, literature and art.
We have more securely attributed musical works by her than any other composer until the 14th century. There are nearly 80 pieces.
She wrote so much music. She had so much to say.
She also wrote nearly 400 letters. Many of them survive, and also copies of letters that people wrote to her. Hildegard was a religious reformer. She thought that the church was in dire straits.
Reforming what about the church?
It was about getting rid of abuses, such as simony, the selling of church offices.
She was allowed her say.
Because she lived in the 12th century, and this was a pretty good time for women, especially in the Rhineland. There was a major campaign to educate nuns. By the close of the 13th century, things were changing, and women were being increasingly pushed behind the walls of the convent.
She was a herbalist, she was an artist, she encouraged people to learn and to sing, she advised popes.
She was very interested in the study of science, and she knew science as it existed in her particular time and place. All of her music relates to the beginnings of time, to the ends of time, and it connects her community and the ongoing work of that community to the spinning of the planets.
So I do feel like it really surpasses religion. It's what we're doing as humans. We always are looking for this sort of magic, longing to be haunted. We long for something which we can't put our fingers on. And I feel like her music really does that.
The BBC's Nicola Stanbridge with that report. This is Rebecca Kesby with NewsHour live from the BBC. In Ukraine, there are new plans to draft another 160,000 people into the army as Russia continues its war in the east. Parliament approved a new mobilisation today. Yesterday, NATO declared it had evidence that thousands of North Korean troops were being sent to fight in the Kursk border region of Russia, where Ukrainian troops took land earlier in the summer. The Moscow now says it's captured new ground, taking several towns and villages in the east. Our Kyiv correspondent James Waterhouse gave us the details.
Yeah, there's certainly a lot of Russian volume on this in terms of the claims being made. What Moscow is claiming is that it has taken a town, a coal mining town called Surirova, which is in the eastern Donetsk region, as well as a few surrounding villages. And this is a part of the front line which Russia has been throwing everything at, really, for the past 6 weeks or so. And monitoring channels are also indicating that Russia is in control at least of large parts of this area. So now the question becomes, well, how much has that taken the wind out of the sails of invading forces as they continue to attack another town, one called Pokrovsk, which is far more strategically significant. It's a major transport hub. And this is a part of Ukraine where Russia is just using raw numbers to move forward. It's got more men. It's got deeper resources. We haven't heard any word from Kyiv on to what extent they are true. But clearly, the story of the battlefield at the moment is one of Russia edging forward. And I think if you're Ukraine, and if you're looking at the involvement of North Korean troops, potentially, if you're looking at the upcoming US presidential election, you know, these are really anxious, especially so uncertain times.
Yeah, you mentioned North Korea there. Yesterday, NATO was saying that they had evidence that North Korean troops were being sent to the Kursk region. Today, the Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, said he'd been talking to his South Korean counterpart. And I think on social media, he said the conclusion is clear. This war is becoming internationalized, extending beyond two countries. That sounds quite worrying.
Certainly so. And I think if you're Ukraine, you want to talk this up as much as possible. Because until now, it had been Ukraine's Western allies, NATO members, who'd said, look, we don't want a world war. We want to keep this war's footprint as small as possible. And then you have Russia extend its relationship with North Korea in terms of it not just being ammunition provided by Pyongyang, but troops now as well. And it is how South Korea has responded angrily, which is changing the dynamic here, because South Korea is entertaining all options in terms of supplying Ukraine with lethal aid. Both leaders are going to talk about how they're going to respond to North Korean troops being deployed in this way. And the reason South Korea is concerned is because Russia gets troops from North Korea, but North Korea gives their forces battleground experience. They get to improve their own technologies, including drone warfare. And this is something that cuts to the heart of South Korean security. And so when you see it spread like that, President Zelensky will be thinking, right, how can I get the attention of my own allies to say, look, it's expanding whether you like it or not. You know, you're going to join forces here and try and minimize this and nullify Russia's continued invasion. It's a hope at this stage, but I think there is a geopolitical significance rather than a battlefield one, because the troops we're talking about so far are relatively small in numbers.
James Waterhouse in Kyiv. Earlier we heard from Gaza, now let's turn our attention to Lebanon, because today 8 UN peacekeeping soldiers were injured when their base in Nakoura was hit by a rocket. The suspicion is it could have been fired by Hezbollah militants. Well, it follows Israeli airstrikes in the Bekaa Valley that the Lebanese health ministry says have killed at least 60 people and injured dozens more. Around a million people have been displaced since Israel invaded southern Lebanon in late September. The Israeli Israeli government says it's targeting Hezbollah militants, but civilians are bearing the brunt of the humanitarian crisis. Sohar Zaita runs the charity, the Lebanese Food Bank in Beirut, and she told me about some of the challenges they face.
So Lebanese Food Bank started the night of the 23rd of September. We gathered in the municipality of Beirut with the disaster management, and we started planning of what should be done for these displaced families. And as a food bank, our field to cover hot meals, food boxes, anything related to food. So the second day, we started collaborating with our social kitchens that we used to work with in Beirut. We started in Beirut. We covered 5 schools. At the beginning, we were just feeding only 1,500 individuals. Later on, with time and the crisis got bigger, now we reached 36 schools, shelters, who are covering with a lunch meal inside and outside Beirut, around 6,500 individuals on a daily basis from Monday till Sunday. We are reaching and we are delivering hot meals for lunch.
That sounds like a big operation, which you've upscaled a lot in the past few weeks. Do you have enough supplies, and what sort of meals are you preparing for people?
Thanks to our donors from inside and outside Lebanon, they supported us, and most of them are corporate, international companies. It's a bit dangerous now because all the funds started to end. From now till first days of November, it's going to be risky.
Risky because you may not have enough supplies or...
Yeah, enough funds to cover all these hot meals.
Okay.
Because we are covering Lebanese dishes that we cook at home with protein, chicken, meat. Sometimes we do some vegetarian meals, but it's only 2 times per week. It is very... they are expensive, but at the same time, you cannot offer something not healthy or not nutritious.
You're trying to give them healthy meals that will keep them going. Yeah,
of course.
I mean, there's more than 1 million people now displaced. Yeah. Most have come up from the south of Lebanon. But I mean, we've heard that there are people, making makeshift shelters in Beirut, trying to find shelter wherever they can. What does that look like in the center of Beirut?
It's more difficult to cover the needs of all these families in Beirut and outside Beirut, because a lot of families moved to the north. The families, they left their houses without taking anything from them, even their clothes. Maybe they took only their ideas and amount of money, and that's it. You see cars everywhere, parking in places that you cannot park. Streets are full of people. Wherever you go in Beirut, displaced families, part of the families are sitting in the shelters, others sleeping in their cars.
Zohar Zaita there from the Lebanese Food Bank in Beirut, one of those trying to help the displaced people. That's it for this edition of NewsHour from us all here in London. Thanks very much for joining us.